Hey, y'all. In Wilder, Kentucky, an unassuming country western bar is the setting for a rumored portal to hell, dark and demonic entities and demonic possession. It is often purported to be the most haunted nightclub in America. Sometimes patrons experience something supernatural, but occasionally something follows them home. I'm Candace, and I'll be your guide. Bobby Mackey's Music World is a little honky-tonk bar with a big, dark history. Initially, upon its construction in 1850, it was a large slaughterhouse and meatpacking facility, responsible for distribution of beef for parts of both Kentucky and Ohio. In the basement of the facility was a well that led from that basement to the Licking River immediately behind the building. It is said that the well was used for the disposal of blood, guts, and any other waste from the slaughtered animals. In the 1890s, the slaughterhouse closed and stood empty for a few years. It is said that during that time, a satanic cult discovered the building and used the basement in particular for their ritual space. The well that I mentioned came in quite handy for disposal of the small animals used for ritual sacrifice. The darkest rumor is that it is possible that not only animals were used for those sacrifices. In 1896, a 22-year-old woman named Pearl Bryan from nearby Greencastle, Indiana, discovered that she was pregnant. When she told her boyfriend, Scott Jackson, about the pregnancy, he was horrified. He instructed her that he wanted her to have an abortion right away. Being a student of a nearby dental school, he believed that he had the medical know-how to perform the task. So, together with his roommate, Alonzo Walling, they attempted to abort Pearl Bryan's baby. However, something went terribly wrong. Some sources say they accidentally killed Pearl while attempting the abortion. Others say that the two men became carried away and killed her intentionally. Either way, Pearl passed away, and Scott and Alonzo decapitated her to make identification more difficult. They left Pearl's body in a field less than 2 miles from the former slaughterhouse. Pearl's head was never found, and it is said that this is because Scott Jackson was a member of that satanic cult that practiced in the basement, and he threw her head into the well. When Pearl's headless body was found in that field, Scott and Alonzo had neglected to remove her shoes, which were a crucial factor in identifying her body. The tracking hounds followed the men's scent to the slaughterhouse building. The two men were sentenced to death, and while standing together on the gallows, Alonzo Walling angrily vowed to haunt the area forever. These three spirits of Scott Jackson, Alonzo Walling, and Headless Pearl Bryan are later noted to be frequent visitors of Bobby Mackey's Music World over a century later. The slaughterhouse building was demolished in the early 1900s, and in 1920 a combination casino and speakeasy was constructed in its place. In 1933, when Prohibition ended, the building came under new ownership and was named the Primrose. This caught the attention of Cincinnati mobsters who wanted in on the action at the casino. Here, the source material varies. Some sources state that the owner of the Primrose, Buck Brady, pulled a gun on a mobster in an attempt to protect his establishment, and after being charged with attempted murder, left the casino business forever. Other sources state that the mob successfully took over the Primrose entirely, and Buck was so heartbroken over the loss of his livelihood that he committed suicide in the building. In the 1950s, the building had a rebirth as a nightclub called the Latin Quarter. Johanna, one of the dance hall girls and the daughter of the owner, fell madly in love with Robert Randall, a singer who performed for the club. They intended to run away together, but upon learning about the pregnancy and the young lover's plans, Johanna's father used his mob connections to have Robert Randall killed. Johanna was so distraught that she poisoned her father and then herself while inside the nightclub. Interestingly, the current owner of Bobby Mackey's Music World was named Randy Mackey at birth. But within a day, his mother followed the strong, unexplainable urge to change his name to Robert Randall Mackey. The spirit of Johanna haunts Bobby Mackey's to this day, and patrons often report smelling her signature rose perfume in the air. In 1978, authorities grew weary of the gun violence at the rough-and-tumble Latin Quarter, and after a series of fatal shootings, the nightclub was shut down. That same year, country music artist Bobby Mackey purchased the building and turned it into what is the current Bobby Mackey's Music World. Although Mackey completely renovated the building, installing a sprawling dance floor, mechanical bull, decorating it with memorabilia, the building seems to have held on to its dark history. Staff and patrons alike immediately began to have paranormal experiences at the venue. Bobby Mackey's wife, Janet, herself refuses to enter the establishment again. Very shortly after opening, Janet was upstairs in the old apartment above the bar. She saw an apparition of a man who told her to get out. Then she felt controlled to the top of the stairs before being thrown down the staircase. At the time, she was 5 months pregnant, but thankfully her and the child were unharmed. She has refused to set foot in the building ever since. Afterward, Douglas Hensley, author of Hell's Gate, a novel about the history of Bobby Mackey's, showed Janet photos of Scott Jackson and Alonzo Walling, the men who murdered Pearl Bryan. Janet identified Alonzo as the apparition that she saw at the top of the stairs. As for Bobby Mackey himself, he is as skeptical as they come, but he states that he could never dismiss the experiences of his wife, staff, patrons, police, and the general public who have experienced so many things at his bar. One of those people is Carl Lawson. Carl was the caretaker at Bobby Mackey's for many years until his death in January 2012. He provided general repair and upkeep of the bar in exchange for residence in the apartment upstairs. Carl tried to cope with living in such a haunted location, and this was reflected with an unfortunate struggle with alcoholism and possible mental illness. Carl had numerous reports of supernatural occurrences at Bobby Mackey's. At one point, he told others of taking a bath in his apartment, and while he was bathing, he felt two hands, one on each shoulder, trying to push him down under the water. He also saw apparitions and heard unusual noises after hours. Carl told Bobby, quote, "Every morning around 6 a.m., it sounds like a parade of evil spirits marching through the building," unquote. Carl was so unnerved by his experiences, he was sleeping with a shotgun at this point. Carl Lawson began feeling like he wasn't himself. Spiritual activity in his already quite active apartment had picked up, and he'd begun to feel like something else was inside of him. Once, the Mackeys hired a handyman named Roger to come help Carl with some general maintenance that needed to be done. While Roger and Carl were the only people in the building, Roger noticed two small, dirty handprints on Carl's back. It would have been a prank, Roger imagined, had it not been that Carl could not reach his back himself, and the two had been alone the entire day. At that moment, the two nearly jumped out of their skins as the jukebox suddenly fired up in the empty bar, and the anniversary waltz began to play. Carl's eyes welled up in tears as he was at a loss to explain the event. Upon checking, the main switch was off to that outlet. The jukebox had no lights on at the moment. It should also be mentioned that the current management has also mentioned the anniversary waltz starting up on its own, even from an unplugged jukebox. One evening, as Carl was doing his evening chores at the bar, He crossed the ballroom and descended into the basement. Upon entering, before he could even protect himself, an unseen entity slammed into him, washing him in a sensation of pure evil. Carl doubled over, clutching his abdomen in pain, twisting and turning in agony before falling unconscious to the floor. After activity in the bar was reaching a peak for Carl, the spirit of Buck Brady, owner of the building when it was a casino, instructed Carl to find a way to spiritually seal the well in the basement. It had been filled in with cement at some point in the past, but demons were still able to pass through. Buck explains that the satanic worship that took place in the basement in the past has left it a portal to hell, as is reputed, and demons are coming and going through there. Immediately after the conversation with Buck, who'd been standing there in the flesh and very realistic, Carl heard a series of popping sounds from the next room. He followed the sounds to a large potted cactus plant. He crouched down, turning the pot to investigate the sound, when abruptly the cactus split open and hundreds of baby spiders emerged rapidly, covering Carl. He later explained that they looked like very small tarantulas, dangerous and venomous. In a total panic, thrashing his clothing and his body in an attempt to rid himself of the insects, he ran outside and just leapt right into the murky, licking river. He submerged himself for as long as he could hold his breath, and then emerged, free from the insect hell. Upon his return to the bar, he noted that the cactus was completely intact, as if nothing had happened. He began his descent into the basement, feeling as if Buck would want him to investigate the china room. Carl picked up a pickaxe, conveniently left in the basement, and destroyed part of the floor. Peering into the hole he made, he saw a small, handmade notebook. When he read what was inside, he was chilled and confused. "My name is Johanna, and I beg you to help me. I am a prisoner in hell. Search the spotlight room." That was all that was written in the 3-page handmade journal. Just then, an overwhelming stench enveloped Carl. He tossed the journal back into the hole before running outside to escape the odor. When he gathered the courage to return, the journal was missing. Stolen by a demon, he supposed. Carl's next task was obvious. He headed to the spotlight room, using a hammer, again conveniently located by the ladder, to break the lock on the trap door to enter. After searching through boxes in the attic, he found what he was looking for, a yellowed journal. There are only a few entries, but I'm going to read them all to y'all, sequentially. "Today is Tuesday. My father and I have had another argument. He told me to stay away from Robert. He said this would be his final warning. I don't know what I'm going to do. He said he would kill him. I would rather be dead than be without Robert. It's after 7 in the evening and I'm sick to my stomach. I've been vomiting every day for at least a week. I know what's wrong with me. I'm pregnant with Robert's child. If my father finds out, he'll kill me. Robert and I are going to sneak off together, soon. We're going to Chicago, where Robert has a friend who is a talent agent. He's going to get Robert a job singing in an all-night cabaret and help him pursue his singing career. We're going to get a small flat, and Robert is going to sing 6 nights a week. I don't want to keep dancing as a chorus girl. I need to find an easier job. Being pregnant, I won't take any chances. We have to be careful not to let my father know where we're going. He would hunt us down and kill both of us. He's insane. My father would do anything to keep me from Robert. He said that Robert Randall was a no-count bum. He always calls him by his full name. I call him by the pet name I gave him, Robbie. He laughs at me when I do this. We love each other so much. It's Friday now. Robbie and I are going to sneak off after he sings his last song tonight. I have everything packed for our trip. I can't wait to get out of here. I want to get as far away from my father as possible. I can't believe the day has finally come for me to escape his cruelty. I went to Robbie's dressing room and knocked over and over. No one answered, so I turned the doorknob and walked inside. He wasn't there. The blue shirt he'd been wearing was on the floor, ripped all the way up the back. It was covered in blood. I know my father has killed Robbie. He'll rot in hell for doing this. I don't know what to do. We were getting out of here. I'll never leave now. I'll kill my father and myself. I don't have a life without Robbie. This child inside me has no future without her daddy. I know it's a girl. I'm going to kill my father. He's a rotten, paid killer. He and Red have shot 3 or 4 men that I know of. They killed Tony in here 2 weeks ago over a lousy gambling debt. They took Tony's body down to the basement and carried him through the tunnel to the river. They don't think I know about the tunnel. They use it to bring illegal moonshine into this place. They think everyone is stupid. They get their bootleg whiskey sent here by boat up the Licking River. I can't believe they haven't been caught all the times they've docked the boat and carried off stuff through the tunnel. Well, I'll see they get caught now. I'm going to write a letter to the government and tell them about the secret tunnel these fine, upstanding men use at night. I'm going to tell them about the dead men they hauled to the middle of the Ohio River and dumped overboard. I think they've buried some bodies in the basement. They filled in an old cistern with concrete instead of just covering it over. I wish Buck was still here. He was a kind man. My father had Red run him off. They forced him to sell this place to their boss. They would have killed him if he'd continued refusing their demands. If I knew where Buck was, I would tell him everything I know about my father and his friends. I heard Buck tell my father he would return here someday and get revenge. Buck swore this place would never thrive as a gambling casino again. If there is justice, he'll return, and I sure hope he does. I'm going to take poison and leave this life after I poison my father. If there is life after death, I'll walk this place until my Robert returns for me. It's Sunday now. I don't have much time to write this down. I did it. I poisoned my father. I sat at the kitchen table and watched him pour 3 cups of coffee. He drank every drop. He always drinks 4 or 5 cups in the morning. I drank a cup with him. We're both doomed. The poison is working on me. I can barely see to write this down. My eyes are blurred. I waited until he fell to the floor. I told him I poisoned him and he was going to rot in hell. He laughed and told me he'd sold his soul to the devil and he would be here forever. He said he would control me in death as he has in life. He told me the well was used as a gateway to and from hell. I don't understand what he's talking about. He said the well was the tunnel. He told me they found a sealed-up well in the basement and climbed to the bottom of it. It was used to drain animals' blood into the river when the place was a slaughterhouse years ago. He and his friends dug from the bottom of the well toward the river, reopening the tunnel. He laughed at me and said he would return from hell. He said he would keep Robert from me for all eternity. He said the devil appeared to him in the well, and he sold his soul for immortality. He will use the well to come back here. He told me his friends would cover up our deaths just like they've done before. No one will know we ever existed. He told me the well and the Licking River was used for satanic ceremonies because it flows north just like the Nile River. That's not the worst of it. As my father lay on the floor dying, this spirit came out of him and identified himself as Alonzo Walling. He mocked me, saying it was he who entered my father's body and took control of him, making my father kill Robbie. The spirit laughed and told me he and his friend were hung for killing and beheading a girl named Pearl. The spirit of Alonzo said he would make all pregnant women who entered this place pay with their lives. He said it was his pal, Scott, who actually killed the girl, but he too was hung for the crime, and because of that, all pregnant women would suffer his wrath. He said Pearl's head was buried deep down in the well, and that it was a blood sacrifice to Lucifer. I'm going down to the basement to pray over the tunnel in hopes I can block the evil from coming here again. To whoever finds this book, please find a way to seal the well and keep my father and his friends in hell. You are my only hope. If my prayers don't work, I'll be his prisoner forever, and many more people will suffer their evil wrath. I'll never be with Robert again if you ignore this. My father should be dead by now. My body is trembling from the poison. My mouth is so dry. I don't have much time left. It's funny. I thought I felt my baby move. It's raining outside. I can hear raindrops beating against the roof. I'm going to the basement and do what I can to stop my father and his evil. I'm taking the cover of this book and a few pages with me. If you've found this part of my diary, look in the basement for the other half. I'll try to write down what happens, if I can. I'm looking at the words I just wrote on the wall. Please, Robert, come back for me. The words make me want to cry. I have to go now, or I won't have the strength to walk to the basement. I can't wait any longer. Please help me. I need your help. My love is powerful. I'll find a way to come back and be with Robbie if you, whoever you are, will only help me. Please, I beg you, help me. If I fail, you must seal the well. After reading those final words, Carl searched the wall of the spotlight room to find Johanna's words. There he found a poem. My love is as deep as the sea that flows forever. You ask me when it would end. I tell you never. My love is as bright as the sun that shines forever. You ask me when it will end. I tell you, never. But I will be waiting here with my heart in my hand. My love, I love you so much. You ask me when it will end. I tell you, never. My love is till you die. My heart cries out from hell. I will be waiting here. From this point, Carl discovered bats in the attic and scurried back down the ladder to get away from them. Unfortunately, they followed him through the trapdoor and chased him all the way to the restroom, where he held the door to keep them away. He panicked when a toilet flushed while he was alone in there. Then, a black smoke appeared. Soon, flames began shooting from the floor and a threatening figure appeared, stating that he was Red. Luckily for Carl, the ghost of Buck appeared along with his dog to run Red off, but not before the flames burned up the journal before vanishing. Buck instructed Carl again to seal the well, as well as informing him that Bobby Mackey, aka Robert Randall Mackey, was indeed the reincarnate of Robert Randall, and that Mackey and his family were in danger. Buck also gave Carl an odd vase with the devil's face on it and explained that he would need it. This began Carl's quest. He looked up clairvoyance in the Yellow Pages, and only one would give him the time of day. The other suggested that he was mentally ill or that he needed a priest by this point. The only one willing to help gave him the phone number for another woman, a mysterious woman who seemed to know what he was suffering with before he even explained. She instructed him to meet her where the two rivers meet at midnight, equipped with a vase with the devil's face on it and holy water. He stopped by a Catholic church for holy water before meeting the strange woman who was heavy-set and white-haired, and exactly what he'd imagined. She gave him a small envelope of powder and very specific instructions on how to seal the well with his given ingredients and various prayers. She also warned that evil would come at him from all directions upon re-entering the bar. The demons would attack in every way possible to try to prevent sealing of the well. She explained, "They know you're coming." Upon arrival back to his car, he was greeted by the ghostly apparition of a corpse with a noose around its neck, smiling at him from the passenger seat. This drove home just how his night was going to proceed. Once Carl arrived back at the bar, he carefully crept inside. As he got near the closest end of the bar, something large, imposing, and completely unseen rushed at him, slamming into him as he attempted to run away. But this time, he tried his hardest not to show fear and attempted a slight smile. Ahead of him, the hallway doors inexplicably sprung open, then slammed shut. He knew this was only the beginning of the trials the woman warned him were to come. Glass partition doors were flapping violently, but he tried not to be swayed. He walked steadily toward the ballroom when an invisible force picked him up from the ground, squeezing him tightly. He kicked and fought with all his might before remembering the holy water. He opened the pint bottle and shook it onto his invisible foe. The entity let out a banshee-like shriek that reverberated throughout the building. Then Carl could see what he was dealing with. A 7-foot tall, somewhat humanoid figure was in front of him. The body of a man, the face of a goat, and pendulous breasts on its chest were all covered with white hair. It snarled at Carl, baring its yellow canine-like teeth. Carl splashed it again, and chunks of meat began falling from the creature's face and body with that same unmistakable shriek of pain. Carl could hear the wet sound of chunks of flesh covered in fur smacking the hard floor below. The demon pointed a now skeletal finger at Carl, warning him,
"You'll die,"
before disappearing into a nearby mirror. Carl Lawson continued his mission, walking slowly, carefully, and utterly terrified through Bobby Mackey's music world. As he neared the front entrance, he again felt a large, imposing, and invisible foe rushing toward him. He slammed himself against the front doors to find them impassable, as if they'd been barred shut. He changed course and ran frantically into the nearby casino room. He bolted the lock on the door behind him and listened as he heard and felt heavy, large, angry footsteps on the other side of that locked door. Suddenly, three panels on the wall of the room sprung open, revealing a never-before-seen small hidden chamber between two walls. As he tried to sort through his confusion on what to do next, the latch on the door to the room sprung open in what he explained was akin to a bolt-action rifle. There was no time to think. He dove into the small, newfound chamber in hopes it would save him from whatever was entering the casino room. The moment he entered that secret room, the three panels sprung shut, concealing his presence. He listened intently, and when he felt reasonably assured nothing was on the other side waiting for him, he tried to exit the chamber. Only, those three panels were not opening for him this time. He hit, kicked, and pried at the wall, begging for it to give way, to no avail. Suddenly, he felt a breath on his neck and realized he wasn't alone in that tiny entombment. He turned and saw a small, half-dead-looking man. Balding and rotting, it looked at him with glowing red eyes before laughing at Carl, an inhuman laugh, and a stench began filling the chamber. The walls and floors were shaking. This time when he reached for the secret panels, they opened for him, allowing him to fall backwards from his hiding place. The tiny man appeared to be gone, but he kicked the paneling closed, just in case. As he proceeded into the next area, the building erupted into a cacophony of sounds in the present room and the others. Clawing, scraping, screeching, nails on a chalkboard, furniture tumbling, and walls shaking. He made his way down the stairs to the basement, occasionally feeling eyes on him. He would stop and wait to see what assault was coming next, but nothing. He got to the china room where he saw a portly, bald man standing in the doorway. The man had gray, beady eyes and was holding both a meat cleaver and a large butcher knife in the other. He was wearing a butcher's apron covered in blood. He raised the cleaver and charged the terrified caretaker. In that moment, Carl later explained he almost welcomed death. Instead, he closed his eyes in fear and felt a cold, piercing feeling rush through him. When he opened his eyes, the man was gone. He prayed aloud for the strength to complete his task. He moved into the china room when he heard laughing and quickly turned to see six black-robed figures standing there holding a calf. One offered for him to join them to reap the blessings of Satan. He swore at them and continued on despite the sounds of their chanting. He heard more disembodied sounds coming from upstairs, a scream, a gunshot, then the jukebox firing up on its own to play the anniversary waltz. To his left, a heavy steel door opened so quickly it fell from its hinges with a loud boom to the cement floor. There hung Alonzo and Scott from their hangman's nooses, levitating in the air. Alonzo's eyes slowly opened, revealing them to be inky black. Then, Carl horrifically realized that Alonzo was holding Pearl Bryan's head in his hand. The two hanging apparitions made crude jokes to one another about Pearl's demise, while Carl frantically worked to follow the careful instructions from the mysterious woman. Mixing powders, transferring the holy mixture to the strange devil vase. He began pouring the potion into the well, reciting the prayers the woman had specified. As he did, something with a vice-like grip grabbed him by the ankles and began dragging him away from the well, causing him to drop the vase. He repeatedly screamed, "I rebuke you, Satan, and seal you in hell for all eternity!" He fought as hard as he could, unseen hands now multiplying and grabbing his entire body. The same evil stench filling the room, and what sounded like a freight train coming through the room. He began to lose consciousness just as he felt something pick him up and spin him rapidly in the air. He had failed. The unseen demon flung him with such force his head hit the cement wall of the china room, knocking him to the edge of consciousness, fighting to stay coherent. He squinted to see a ball of flame coming up through the well. From within the flames, he saw the form of the goatman demon he'd seen earlier. It told him,
"Bow to me and become my disciple, or I'll feed your soul to the flames of hell."
Carl attempted to throw a rock at the demon before slipping into unconsciousness. It was about this point where Janet decided that enough was enough. She'd heard so many stories from Carl about the spirits and demons that haunted the bar, along with numerous experiences from trade workers and friends who sometimes had to run, terrified from the establishment, due to what they experienced there. Janet confronted Bobby and explained that she was going to call a psychic whether he liked it or not. Bobby, the non-believer, scoffed but told her to go ahead and do that if it keeps her from coming to him constantly, worried about the haints at their business. Janet reached out to Patricia Mitchell, a world-renowned psychic known for assisting many police departments with investigations throughout the United States. But she also did outreach programs to numerous countries as well, offering her aid to anyone who needed it. Carl relayed some of the stories of the spectral residents to Janet, but she requested that he not share the finer details so that she could read things as accurately as possible. After Patricia, the psychic's, investigation, she called Janet to explain what she felt about the building. She explained that in certain areas she felt sick and felt death. A lot of death, were her words. She also explained that she could see a woman's head floating in water under the floor. Janet later relayed to her husband that, quote, "She said you were a singer at the nightclub in another era. Your name was Robert Randall, and some girl's jealous father murdered you in the place. Her name was Johanna," unquote. Possibly the most alarming piece of information received from the psychic was when she told Janet, quote, "The ghosts are using Carl's body at will, and they can be very dangerous when provoked," unquote. At this time, Janet demanded that Bobby Mackey contact his friend Larry, who says he has a close friend who is a Pentecostal pastor. Not without a lot of resistance from skeptical Bobby, he did so. Thankfully, his friend Larry understood Bobby would never reach out in a situation like this unless there was some measure of truth to it. So Larry and Pastor Glenn Cole made plans to visit Bobby Mackey's, most importantly, to talk to Carl, as Pastor Cole was very concerned that Carl could be in serious danger without even realizing it. That Saturday night, Bobby relayed the information to the caretaker, Carl, that his friend Larry and Pastor Cole were coming to discuss the demons at the bar and wanted to talk to Carl in particular. Carl was deep down grateful as he knew something controlled him at times and was having lapses in memory, but he was very uneasy what the spirits may do to him. Bobby went on stage to perform a love song in a packed house that night, while Carl sat at the bar amongst the patrons. He smelled a quick whiff of smoke and is looking around when suddenly he hears someone calling out, "Fire! Fire!" Bobby instructs the large crowd to evacuate the building, which thankfully everybody does in an orderly fashion. Carl, in the meantime, ran toward the old kitchen area of the building. Upon flinging open the door, he sees the west wall of the kitchen engulfed in flames. Carl and the other staff worked fervently, emptying fire extinguishers onto the flames on the inside and the outside of the building. Thankfully, the Wilder Fire Department arrived quickly, soaking the kitchen to extinguish the flame. The craziest part is, the crowd actually waited outside throughout this whole thing, and when the fire department okayed the bar to resume, Bobby invited everyone back inside with a smile and told them, quote, "You're the most loyal fans a man could ask for. Let's get back to the music," unquote. It went back to business as usual the night of the fire. The dance floor was packed, Bobby Mackey and his band playing joyfully, drinks being poured left and right. But all Carl could do is wonder if that fire had been a warning. He'd heard the fire chief tell Bobby the fire was unexplainable, as no wiring was in that outside wall that had ignited. Had the spirits done this because they were angry about the upcoming visit from the pastor? Once the bar had closed for the night, Carl walked into the kitchen and softly asked the spirits of the building not to hurt the building or himself. He asked them if they started the fire because they were angry about the pastor to please feel better, because Carl wouldn't allow the pastor to run them off. He pleaded directly to the spirits of Johanna, the dance hall girl who poisoned the father and herself, and Buck, the spirit of the man who'd owned the bar when the mob took over. At this moment, Carl heard a loud, heavy breathing that seemed to reverberate through the walls of the building itself. He took this to be a sigh of relief, that perhaps the building had heard him and felt reassured and wasn't too angry. Either way, Carl was too frightened to sleep in his apartment over the bar that night. Bobby had asked him to keep a close eye on the building that night just in case there was another fire issue, so Carl sat in his car, staring at the building all night. Thursday arrived, the day of the exorcism. Larry met preacher Glenn Cole in the parking lot to inform the pastor that he'd invited three cameramen and a news reporter, just in case anything happened. The cameras were set up in the still damaged kitchen area, along with a small table with four chairs. Reverend Cole began with a short prayer, then began reading Bible passages, quickly, loudly, and passionately. At various points, he asked questions of Carl and the spirits. Carl held the same stance, that he was worried something would harm him if they were forced from his body or the building. Quote, "I feel like something's trying to tell me to tell you that they'll leave me alone if you don't try to make them leave this building. They want to stay here. It's where they belong," unquote. Reverend Cole continued his preaching, fire and brimstone. Ultimately, he put his hands on Carl's wrists, demanding loudly and furiously that anything in Carl needs to leave his body. Carl began shaking, increasingly violently, and eventually thrashing. Eventually, Carl fell limply onto the table he was seated at. He looked at Pastor Cole with a small smile and told him that something had changed and that he felt different. The cameraman and news reporter packed up, disappointed that they didn't get any great footage of something they hoped would be suited for a horror movie. After checking on Carl, who stepped out to smoke a cigarette, Larry and Reverend Cole spoke with one another in the parking lot. Cole explained to Larry that it wasn't over. Nothing had left. Either the spirits were hanging in there, or Carl was protecting them. but they had to tread carefully from here. Cole felt like with that many people in the room, they wouldn't have success, so they'd need to reattempt this sometime soon with more privacy. After Carl finished his cigarette on his way upstairs to his apartment, he said, "I told you I wouldn't let them run you off." A week passed by, and Carl began to wonder if something had indeed changed because he hadn't seen any obvious spirit activity, and he actually felt at peace for the first time in a long time. That night, Carl received a surprise visit from Larry and Reverend Cole. Carl greeted them warmly before welcoming them inside and entertaining them with idle chit-chat for a while. Eventually, Preacher Cole just bluntly asked Carl if the spirits were still there. Immediately, a deep, raspy, multi-tonal voice erupted that wasn't Carl's.
"Yes, we're still here."
Carl's face changed, twisted with anger. Larry pulled out the camcorder he'd brought along, and despite testing it beforehand, it wouldn't work at all. Carl snarled.
"We've been here long before you came around. We've never harmed anyone, so why do you want us to leave? Is Carl Lawson worth all of the lives you're going to cost if you try to make us leave?"
Carl came back to himself for a moment to plead with Pastor Cole. Carl looked at him terrified and wide-eyed. "Glenn, there's something coming in and out of me, and I want it to leave me alone. I want a life of peace. I'm not their property." Apparently, Preacher Cole and Larry had somewhere else to be that night, so they left Carl alone at the bar, telling him to pray constantly and to not eat too much, as he would have to fast to remove the demons from his body. With that, they were gone. Carl was terrified he angered the demons by telling the men that he wanted them gone. At that moment, he felt a wetness in his groin area. He ran to the nearby ladies' room, flipped on the lights, and checked the mirror to see that it was blood. Lots of blood. It had soaked his white shorts and was still oozing from large sores that were suddenly covering his rectal area. The sores were enlarging and spreading right before his eyes. They had appeared from out of nowhere. He screamed apologies to the demons that inhabit his body and the bar, and he ran upstairs to his apartment to get into a bath. He knew this was their punishment, and he promised them that he would never let the Reverend return again. Another week passed without any obvious issues. Carl had gone to the doctor and received medication for his sores, which had only improved slightly, but they were still very painful. He spent these days increasingly nauseated, unable to eat, unable to get or stay warm. He just felt sicker by the day. He got into a bath to soak his sores as instructed, and slowly, a foul stench filled his bathroom. He couldn't see a presence, but he definitely felt one, and he looked terrified around the room. Just then, the door suddenly sprung open, hard, slamming against the interior wall. Several long, terrifying seconds passed before Carl heard a raspy voice say,
"I told you to tell that preacher to piss off."
The same door then slammed shut, and the stench in the room intensified, causing Carl to vomit the small amount he'd been able to eat into his bath water. He went to try to stand up, but once he got into a crouching position, he felt the entity hit him in the stomach, then in the jaw, knocking him back down into the bathwater. At that moment, he felt the entity grab his hair and shove his head down into the bathwater, trying to drown him. He looked up through the water and could now see the face of the unseen spirit, and it was Alonzo Walling. Carl thrashed and fought for his life to again have the raspy voice fill his ears.
Tell that preacher to piss off. Bow to Satan or die now,
it said to him, as the bathwater changed to bright red blood. Carl screamed underwater, I bow, accidentally swallowing gulps of the red blood. As he did so, everything suddenly stopped. Carl coughed and sputtered, sobbing as he scrambled from the tub and tried his best to dry the blood from his body. He quickly put some clothes on, flung open the door to his apartment, and bounded down the stairs two at a time. He ran frantically through the mirrored hallway, not chancing a look around. His freedom and hopeful safety was within sight. Then he froze in terror when he could see that standing at the front door stood Larry and Pastor Glenn Cole. Now Carl understood that the demons knew they were coming. Carl let them in but tried to get out of the situation, refusing to tell them what had just happened in fear of more retaliation. He frantically tried to reschedule and make excuses, but Reverend Cole wouldn't allow it and reassured Carl that they wouldn't hurt him once it was all finished. They returned to that same table in the kitchen as Larry set up two video cameras on the table before excusing Carl and Cole to be alone. Pastor Cole explained to a worried Carl that the good spirits would have to leave him along with the bad ones. Carl was heartbroken over this and sadly said, Even Johanna and Buck? They don't bother anybody. They're my friends. They're the only ones I have to keep me company during the week. Without them, I'll be all alone. Carl lost the argument and was persuaded by Reverend Cole to cooperate with the process. And on August 1st, 1991, at almost 9 o'clock p.m., the exorcism of Carl Lawson began. As they began the process, two different entities identified themselves by name as residing within Carl. Both with voices distinctly different from one another, they identified both their first and last names and that they'd been in there for years. Neither name was an entity known to inhabit Bobby Mackey's music world. The demons threatened to come back and to bring seven more with them. Pastor Cole recalled biblical teachings of the sevenfold return of demons, reinforcing his belief that that is what they were dealing with. After some arguing back and forth with the entities, a third revealed itself as well. As Pastor Cole was preaching Bible verses over Carl and demanding the spirits to leave, arguing with them, Carl's body dropped to the floor and stared, empty, at the ceiling. A chorus of voices erupted from him that they would not leave. They did not need Carl, but they did need his body, they explained. At one point, Preacher Cole told the demons he would bind them from doing further harm because he had the power of God inside him. The voices replied,
What in the hell do you think you got to bind me with? My Lord is on his way. He's coming right now.
Bring him on, Pastor Cole threatened the demons. At this point, the room began to fill with a disgusting, sickening smell.
He's coming down strong, and I'll tell you what, there ain't a damn holy man ever gonna come in here and try to run us off again, because there's thousands of us here. We've been here for years.
An empty wheelbarrow sat beside Carl, who was still on the floor. At this point, he lurched upward, grabbed the wheelbarrow handles, and flipped it over, leaping up onto it on all fours, hissing and growling like a wild animal. His face began twisting into grotesque expressions, and the light in the kitchen they were in began flickering. Door slamming and the sound of general commotion was heard coming from both the basement and the attic. Carl's breathing became labored and he began violently shuddering. "Depart, you spirits, and go back to the world where you belong," Cole shouted as he wrestled Carl to the ground, the Reverend bending over to place his hand on Carl's head, demanding the spirits to leave. The noises around them ramped up, and the very walls of the building began shaking. After more fire and brimstone poured from the preacher, finally that same foul odor emanated from Carl's mouth, and his tongue began thrashing about. Until finally, a new voice came from Carl's mouth.
"They're all gone but me. You're talking to Alonzo. If you want that bitch Pearl's head, dig under this floor. They hung me and my friend for the crime. Did you know that? And that ain't all. It was me that threw that pregnant woman down the stairs in here. I died for killing one pregnant woman and her baby, so what's one more?"
The pastor continued preaching scripture, shouting and making commands of the demon inhabiting Carl's body, until finally, after 6 hours of this struggle, Carl went limp into Reverend Cole's arms. Carl Lawson had no recollection of the events that had just unfolded. He awoke confused, but relieved. The preacher explained that the demons could return sevenfold if Carl opens the door for them in any way, and that Carl must not entertain or even welcome the friendly spirits back in. The terrible sores that had been plaguing his rectal area were suddenly gone after the ordeal. That was seemingly the end of the possession of Carl Lawson. While Bobby Mackey is still skeptical of the claims of demons and hauntings, after watching the recorded tape of Carl's exorcism, he suddenly made the decision to relocate the bar to a piece of land a couple doors down from its current location. Just as groundbreaking was about to begin, abruptly the ground opened up on that lot and it split spontaneously along its entirety into a 60-foot deep fissure in the ground. The Corps of Engineers had to declare the land unsafe to build on, leaving Bobby Mackey no choice but to leave the bar where it stands today. Of course, while Carl was the most noteworthy paranormal witness to these hauntings, he's far from the only one. There are many stories stemming from Bobby Mackey's music world, both old and new. The crew from the popular TV show Ghost Adventures refuses to return to Bobby Mackey's. Zach Baggins explains that the crew heard an entity use his voice through a spirit box, telling them to be careful. Once he returned home, he was seeing shadow people in his home. Objects were being thrown about. He was hearing unexplained noises and his friends were being attacked. He explains that the entities at Bobby Mackey's affect you more personally than most places and form strong attachments. One particularly intriguing story is the one of Michael and Mikkel, detailed in a video from Living Dead Paranormal on YouTube. The pair, who openly admit to being recovering addicts, visited Bobby Mackey's as your typical patrons to dance and have a good time. They claim that something followed them home from the honky-tonk bar that scratches them occasionally, manifests as shadow people, and routinely causes the sound of footsteps and pictures falling off the walls with great force. During the investigation, an EVP was received stating, quote, "Get out. I can make you." Unquote. Living Dead Paranormal also experienced a lot of spirit box activity while at Michael and Mikkel's home. The spirit box repeatedly stated that the spirit present in the pair's home is named Carl Lawson. Remember, Carl died in 2012 after a battle with alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver. Employees at Bobby Mackey's assert the idea, claiming that there is a new entity at the bar with Carl's mannerisms, and they accept that he joined his friends Buck and Johanna after death and haunting the venue. Some report seeing Carl in photos they've taken while investigating the venue. Interestingly, during the investigation, the Living Dead Paranormal did both at Michael and Mikkel's home, as well as at Bobby Mackey's. Investigator Josh was grabbed on the shoulder by an unseen entity. Afterwards, he states he was awoken every morning at 4 a.m. for weeks following the investigations. Of course, for every eventful story that takes place at the venue, there are numerous smaller encounters reported. One man reports being attacked in the bathroom by a spirit in a cowboy hat. The customer attempted to sue Mackey for $1,000, which led to a court order for Bobby to put up a sign stating that the bar is said to be haunted and management is not responsible for any damage. Some state that while in the basement, they feel a malicious push or pull, and some believe a demon with glowing eyes resides in the basement as well. Local police generally agree that the building is haunted after making several trips to the bar in the middle of the night due to figures or shadow people standing in the windows, mysterious noises, and of course, the jukebox playing on its own while the building is unoccupied. Joe, an employee at the establishment, reports once walking into a room without turning on the light when he saw something out of the corner of his eye coming straight at his head. He barely dodged in time to find a metal bracket, which had been lying on a table inside the room, flying past his head and into the wall behind him. One patron was in the men's restroom when the room suddenly became swelteringly hot. A large metal trash can next to the bathroom sink abruptly flung across the room. Then he sees a man with a handlebar mustache stating, "Die game, die game," which is Latin for dying well or dying good. Of note, Alonzo Walling had a handlebar mustache. Another employee reports often seeing a very angry man behind the bar, as well as the spirit of Johanna, who leaves the scent of roses in her wake. Sometimes female patrons sitting at the bar report feeling touched or groped while seated in the area. Of course, there's no shortage of disembodied sounds, women singing or humming, chairs scooting, unexplained bangs and thuds, the well-known anniversary waltz from the jukebox, heavy footsteps, etc. Interestingly, many people report feeling a cat rubbing against their legs while at the establishment. I've only recently learned of the strange connection between demons and cat experiences. The more recent caretaker, Matt Coates, state that he came to the basement one night to find what he calls a satanic circle on the floor, glowing green. He felt the floor to find it burning hot. This took place in the Room of Faces, which gets its name from the old water stains on the wall, which can look like faces depending on the angle they're seen from. Caitlin from the Mysterious-ish podcast reports that she felt a cold spot right where an SLS camera picked up a possible figure, as well as feeling an entity in the basement, in the Room of Faces, pass through her body, lingering for a moment before exiting, leaving her terrified and riddled with goosebumps. Probably unsurprisingly, she doesn't feel the need to ever return to Bobby Mackey's music world. Despite the abundance of evil in its reputation, Bobby Mackey's music world remains open to this day. Current reviews claim that it is in a perpetual, ramshackle way, and that the strange stories are still experienced frequently here, particularly on the paranormal tours that take patrons into the basement area. Many suspect that the demons have returned to the bar, considering the type of paranormal activity still encountered. Well, now we have to wonder if Carl Lawson has joined them. Well, y'all, that's the story of Bobby Mackey's music world. Well, only some of it. Now let's talk about it. All right, y'all. Whoo, that is a big one. Let me tell you up front that there is so much to the story of this place, and that was only a chunk of it. I basically kept it as short as possible, and it's still a long episode. I've mentioned before how I eat up good sources. The book The Exorcism of Carl Lawson is perfect. I mentioned Douglas Hensley in the story. Doug is a friend of Bobby Mackey's who chronicled the stories and the exorcism as it happened. So this book gave me so much good information. Doug was present for the exorcism. He heard all of Carl's stories immediately after they'd happened. So it's really good background information that isn't easily found in other places. So that's where I got a ton of this from. And if the story appeals to you, I recommend that you read that book because, again, there was so much that I couldn't cover. That was only a tiny sliver of the absolutely terrifying stories from that time frame. Unfortunately, the word of mouth history from the building cannot all be corroborated by the records. For instance, they did find a Johanna that died of poisoning. She does match the demographics. I believe I recall they possibly found a father that seemed to match, but there is zero proof that it happened at Bobby Mackey's, only that it happened in the county. And Pearl Bryan, there's really no record of. I believe that the loose history of the building is accurate, you know, slaughterhouse to nightclub, all of that. Obviously, there's no way to prove if satanic practice was a part of it, so that's completely unverifiable. It is fascinating to me that Alonzo Walling is maintained as such a prominent, malevolent haunting even now. It just seems kind of surprising to me because it was Scott Jackson's girlfriend that they killed, but Alonzo was the one sticking around to cause all of the problems. At least the primary figure causing all the problems. All right, so now to the really big question at hand. Was Carl possessed? Some may feel that it's just so apparent that he was, but it's also just such an outlandish story. Plenty of it is believable enough to me in its paranormal weirdness. But the level of detail in the experiences, the sheer number of all of these vivid characters, those things make me feel like it can't be, right? For instance, the spirit of Buck showing up to fight the newly met spirit of Redaway with his dog and giving Carl a weird vase with a devil face on it? How did he materialize that? How does a ghost make a vase that is perfect for the upcoming ritual needed to seal the well? And it's just so painfully convenient that Johanna's diary went missing. Both halves of it were just destroyed or stolen instantaneously. But despite that, Carl was able to read it one time under duress and still transcribe it accurately and consistently in such great detail. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but he has one hell of a memory. And of course, it is maddening to me that we don't even know if it really existed. We can't see photos of it. We can't read it. And I wish I knew more about Johanna's supposed poem on the wall of the spotlight room. Like, have other people seen this? Is it real? Is it known to be there? Is Carl the only one who spotted it? Does it seem accurate to the era in terms of age, gender, handwriting? That would be such crucial evidence for veracity. Also, the hidden chamber that sprung open for him to hide inside. Was that verified? Because they can go look for this hidden chamber. I would love to know if it actually exists. And that part was fascinating to me because in the story, when Carl became trapped in there, he feared that the spirits tricked him in there to hold him there. But I have to wonder, if it did happen exactly as he said it did, if one of his friendly ghosts opened that to give him a place to hide, I don't know. Personally, I feel like Carl's story as a whole is a mixture. It's a combination of a man battling alcoholism and potential mental health issues, whether that stems from the alcoholism or is a completely secondary issue of his, as well as being subjected to an environment that probably is haunted, and it sounds like with pretty malevolent entities. I don't doubt that he could very well have been possessed. He definitely could have been. But I don't think the events leading up to the exorcism played out exactly the way that he observed them to be. I think that his environment and the experiences greatly exacerbated his poor mental state. So again, to sum it up, I think yes, There are seriously malevolent hauntings there, and I think he was also a sick man, and the two things played off of each other. And I do believe, as much as I can, despite having seen very little objective evidence, that Bobby Mackey's is haunted with many spirits, and some of them are dark. While normally I would never use Ghost Adventures of all things as a source, it does fascinate me that the cast is too afraid to go there after being there for two episodes. Also, the evidence in the YouTube video from Living Dead Paranormal is pretty convincing. If you like this story, I recommend you go watch that because it is fascinating. I did mention Carl's alcoholism, as well as Michael and Mikkel, the people who had spirits from Bobby Mackey's follow them home. I did mention that they were recovering addicts because addiction is one of those things that can make someone more susceptible to basically picking up entities. I don't understand. You know, again, this is not a science we know a lot about, but it does seem that people in stages of addiction are more susceptible to being haunted. I wish I understood it better, but maybe they're psychologically vulnerable. Who knows? But I wanted to just put a note in there about that, that is the only reason I mentioned their addiction, is because I feel like it is applicable to something targeting them in particular. And I don't mention it as a way of disparaging them whatsoever. Okay, y'all, I'm sorry that I find this funny, but the fact that Pastor Cole showed up that one visit in between when Carl begged him to help him, and I guess Pastor Cole didn't have the time, is just hilariously disturbing. Like, it's really upsetting. But it's a sick kind of funny, too, because poor Carl, I feel so bad for him. He was begging for help from entities living inside of him, and the response was basically, see you later, we'll handle this at some point. Don't eat too much, because you need to be fasting for this. I mean, considering the final exorcism took 6 hours, maybe Reverend Cole just didn't have time for that night. But that is just wild to me that they left him there alone in that condition. I do like to include as much key information from my sources as is possible. I mentioned using the Exorcism of Carl Lawson novel heavily in this. I have decided not to include the names of the demons given during the exorcism in the script. Alonzo Walling is mentioned by name because I feel like I can't leave him out, because he's a prominent figure in the story and is recurring despite, you know, a century of time passing. Granted, the names that the demons give in the novel are very Americanized. Think names like Joe White. So I can't imagine that these are actually demon names, but just in case, I'm erring on the side of caution after being told too many times that you do not call a demon by name. So I just wanted to explain the rationale behind that. How crazy is it that Bobby finally decided to move the bar, which suggests to me that he is creeped out and just doesn't want to admit that, despite his skepticism, that he was creeped out enough to move the bar until the ground opened up? Because that's pretty symbolic of hell right there, when the ground randomly splits 60 feet deep. So interesting that the bar had to remain right where it is now when that happened. I admit, it sounds orchestrated, you know? If spirits can split the ground open, it kind of sounds like maybe they decided that was a good plan. One theory on the excessive number of hauntings at the bar is some people believe that spirits can't cross flowing water. I haven't heard this myself, but you know, as mentioned, the Licking River is directly behind the building, so it could just keep everything trapped in there if there is any validity to that theory. All right, y'all. As always, I want to know what you think. Have you been to Bobby Mackey's? If so, I want to hear about it. You can find me on social media at Obscure Appalachia and check there for photos from today's episode. There should be plenty of good stuff up. Feel free to email me your personal experiences at obscureappalachia@gmail.com. Check out the show notes for information on Caitlin's podcast, Mysterious-ish. Please leave a positive review on your podcast provider if you love the show. Thank you so much to everyone who's already done that. It helps my distribution a lot. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't. Thanks, y'all, for hanging in there for this hefty and heavy episode. Until next time.